Next is H.R. and I.R. versus New Jersey State Parole Board. If counsel could please step forward. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Fletcher Dunn, Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of the petitioner of H.R. Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey as a friend of the court.
Brian Kennedy for the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey as a friend of the court.
Assistant Attorney General James E. Schuster on behalf of the New Jersey State Court.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Duddy.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please go ahead, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. If it would please the court, with your permission, I'd like to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
That's fine.
Thank you very much. Your Honors, in 2015, the United States Supreme Court in Grady versus North Carolina held that the GPS surveillance of a convicted sexual offender is a search under the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution, which is necessarily a search under our state constitution because of our system of federalism. The Supreme Court in Grady stopped short, however, of articulating what the standard ought to be for that search, and instead left it for the states to decide for themselves. And that's what we're here today to do, to decide what the standard for the GPS surveillance search ought to be in New Jersey. Now, there is already an existing framework here in New Jersey to resolve this issue. For many years now, that framework has always been that the search of a parolee, like H.R., requires reasonable suspicion that he either committed a parole violation or a new crime. That existing framework can and should have easily resolved the issue in this case. And in fact, it's simple deductive reasoning, which is A, the parole board needs reasonable suspicion to search a parolee, B, H.R. is a parolee, and so C, therefore, they need reasonable suspicion to search him. That framework could have resolved the issue. Now, the state understands or is not disputing that specific framework, but they have to argue something. They can't acquiesce to this being unconstitutional, and that's understandable. They're charged with defending the parole board's practices. And so to remove this fact pattern outside of that framework, they have to argue something. And so what they're arguing is that this is a special needs search, which requires no suspicion whatsoever. There are four reasons why this cannot be a special needs search for which no suspicion can be required. The first reason, simply, is that it's not a special needs search. The purpose of the surveillance, as made plain in the SOMA statute, is to gather evidence that can be used to prosecute the parolee. The second reason why this cannot be a special needs search for which no suspicion is required is that even if this is a special need beyond the need for traditional law enforcement, we engage in the special needs balancing test here in New Jersey, which requires the court to weigh the degree of intrusion against the government's interest in conducting the search, or more specifically, the advancement of the search advances the government's interest. And under that balancing test, the degree of intrusion significantly outweighs any incremental advancement that the surveillance has in the government's interest. The third reason why this cannot be a special needs search for which no suspicion is required is that special needs searches with no suspicion must be minimal. And that is made very explicit in case law from this court. It's almost a standalone condition, a condition precedent to even getting to the special needs analysis. It must be minimal, and it certainly is anything but that. And the fourth and final reason as to why this cannot be a special needs search for which no suspicion is required is that this court has drawn a very clear line of demarcation between special needs cases that require no suspicion and special needs cases that do require suspicion before they can be conducted. And that line of demarcation, the litmus test for that line, is whether or not the search can result in penal consequences to the searchee. And of course, here they most certainly can. They can result in penal consequences in the long term, which would be comparing the data generated from the GPS device to unresolved sex crimes. And they can also be used to prosecute the parolee in the short term, which is using the data to prove that he violated a condition of his parole, such as traveling outside the state of New Jersey when he was not supposed to do, which is actually even in this record. And so for those four reasons, it's not a special needs search. Even if it is, the balancing test weighs heavily in favor of the parolee here. The search must be minimal, third. And fourth, because the search results in penal consequences or could, it cannot be a special needs search for which no suspicion is required. Getting to the first reason, Your Honors, why this is not a special needs search. As I said, the SOMA statute makes it very plain that generating evidence is what the purpose of the surveillance is. And it makes it very plain that it's generating evidence to compare and contrast to previous sex crimes, but also to let the parole officers know whether or not a parole violation has occurred. Now, the board, the state, is arguing that while the GPS device may in fact be generating evidence, the real purpose, the overarching purpose, is deterrence, to prevent parolees like HR from engaging in recidivistic sexual activity. Why that argument, though, is illogical, frankly, is because for the SOMA surveillance to even have any deterrent effect, it has to be collecting evidence. There would be no deterrent effect if it weren't collecting evidence that could be used against the parolee. The underlying premise here is that when the ankle bracelet is strapped to a parolee like HR, it's telling HR, if you engage in recidivistic conduct or a parole violation, we're going to find out. We're going to find out through the data that we're constantly generating, the evidence that we're constantly gathering. And so this idea that it may or may not be about deterrence, if it is, it's only because of the evidence that's being gathered. Relatedly, every search has some broader societal purpose, whether that broader purpose be deterrence or public safety, which is more or less synonymous with it. Every search has that broader purpose. And so we can't just look to the broader purpose of a search to immunize the underlying legality of it. And in fact, if you look at New Jersey's criminal code, the basic purpose of the criminal code and our criminal justice system is deterrence. It's actually the very second section of the code. The first section of the code says, this is our criminal code. And the second section, 2C1-2, says, the purpose of this code is to deter crime or prevent crime. And so the state's search here can't be immunized by speaking or just kind of referencing that broader purpose.
So here we're talking about a narrow class, tier three offenders that are subject to parole supervision for life. How does that affect your argument that this is about a gathering evidence, general evidence relating to criminal activity?
So the fact that I don't think it affects it at all, Your Honor. The fact that HR may or may not be a Tier 3 offender doesn't speak to the underlying legality of the search and seizure analysis. And so I would grant you that if this were an equal protection argument I was making, or a due process argument, in which case I was saying, look, the government action here, GPS surveillance, doesn't relate. It's irrationally related to the purpose of this, which is to address recidivistic activity by Tier 3 offenders. I think that Your Honor's question would have more bearing on that kind of argument, but we're not here. This is search and seizure analysis. And so, you know, simply put, the fact that he's a Tier 3 registrant, I mean, I suppose that in some minor indirect way kind of relates to the government's interest in the balancing test, but that doesn't speak to whether or not this is a special needs search.
But how could it, you're minimizing the deterrent effect of this. Like one of the restrictions on a Tier 3 offender is the Tier 3 offender cannot go within a certain number of feet of a school, a daycare center, and other such places, correct?
Not under Megan's law. No, not under Megan's law. Megan's law just is purely about public notification. It's not a residency restriction or anything like that.
You're telling
under his parole supervision, that could be a condition.
You're telling me that's not a condition for a three-tier offender? A three-tier offender can go right up to the lobby of the school?
That's not embedded anywhere in the Megan's Law legislation, though, Your Honor. If that is a condition, it would be under PSL, but I'm not even so sure about that. I'm not going to...
I'm asking you like an open-ended question. I thought, and maybe someone will illuminate this, that there is a restriction, maybe I'm wrong about this, on Tier 3 offenders going with a certain footage of schools and daycare centers. Am I wrong about that?
I could be wrong, but I believe that there is no such prescription. That certainly not in Megan's law in 7-1-23. That does not exist.
You're saying you're dismissing deterrence by saying, well, deterrence is really all about law enforcement, and it's not really a valid consideration behind this restriction. But the fact is that deterrence is usually about a potential concern that the individual might have that if they do something else, they might be incarcerated again, might be convicted again and incarcerated again. Now, deterrence can also mean other things. Someone's family or support or job may cause them to want to not offend. But you're saying essentially that if deterrence is intermingled with law enforcement, then we should not consider it to be a valid basis for a special needs search. Your comments were quite dismissive of that. So what is your position as to the role of deterrence?
If it is intermingled with classic law enforcement means, evidence gathering, then it can't be a special needs search. I know that the underlying premise of your question, Your Honor, is that if it is intermingled, then it can be a special needs search.
No, but you're saying, as I understand it, you're saying they're saying it's deterrence, but really, I think I heard you say essentially, don't even consider deterrence because the only way that this is a deterrent is because of the fear of law enforcement, that you're going to be convicted again if you reoffend. You will be found because the GPS will track you, and you will again be convicted. So I think what you're saying is that in a special needs analysis, that when deterrence is the creation of a threat of law enforcement, it's not real deterrence. I think that's what you're saying.
I am saying that. That's the underlying premise of this.
Okay,
that's
so
the underlying fallacy of just referring to this as deterrence, which is that it may well be. I'm assuming that for the purposes of your question, at least, that this may have a deterrent effect on recidivist activity. I would dispute that generally. But
you're telling us not
to
consider it because it's tied in with the threat of law enforcement.
Well, yes. And also it's more than that, as I
said.
What
form of deterrence would be a valid basis for special needs? Because you're saying not the potential for being...
If the search was purely for deterrence, but it was not intermingled with evidence gathering that could result in criminal liability, then it would be okay.
And what would that be?
I can't give you a hypothetical scenario in this setting. I'm here to say that this can't be a special needs search.
Yeah,
I'm not hiding the ball here. I don't think this can be a special needs search.
Okay, but what you're saying is that no search could be justified on deterrence if the deterrence is not independent of law enforcement.
I am saying that.
Yeah.
And
okay.
Supreme Court has said that before. They've used the word divorced. In fact, this was in City of Indianapolis versus Edmond. This is a U.S. Supreme Court case from 2000. And there, the City of Indianapolis had placed checkpoints all over the city to ferret out nefarious drug activity. So they were stopping all the cars that were driving in the area.
The difference between the example you're giving is the difference between a person who has general liberty in society compared to someone who has conditional liberty. This person's on parole. That's a lot different from checkpoints and other types of, of searches. So I want to ask you a question, because there are a lot of restrictions when you are placed on parole. One of them may be that you have to undergo drug testing, okay, on a bi-monthly basis or whatever. That's a search, correct?
Yes, it is. That is a search.
It's done without suspicion, correct?
Yes, it is.
It has a deterrent aspect, correct?
Yes, it is. Yes, it does.
If the person is under the influence, or it may even lead to a violation of parole, it might even lead to evidence that could lead to the person being charged. Am I correct?
Yes.
Nothing wrong with any of those?
No.
Okay. Now, so that's one condition of parole that's permissible. Why, for a person who is in Tier 3 and is reentering society, I'm not talking about 5 years down the line where a person is now showing that he can be offense-free, why isn't the parole board permitted to know whether or not the person is hanging around at a grade school all day long? Why wouldn't that be permissible information in order to assure that he is abiding by the conditions of his parole, and also making certain that he's not committing, that he may not be in a position to commit another crime? Like, what's wrong with that?
So, well, they can do that. They do that. They do that by first ensuring where the person lives, with whom they live, where they work to make sure that it's not close to a daycare center, as you call it. There's unannounced visits. In fact,
That's not going to tell them where he is during the day, where he lives, where he works, okay, or where he may work, doesn't have to work, isn't going to provide them with information about whether or not he's hanging out in front of a grade school, okay, for a good part of the day, correct?
That's correct. The short answer here, though, Your Honor, is that the gravity of the harm that the search is trying to prevent or correct, that's not dispositive on the underlying legality of the search.
So you're right. It's a balancing. The governmental interest to assure that he doesn't recidivate against children, okay? That's a very strong governmental interest, correct?
Correct. But that's not the analysis. The analysis isn't, does the government have an interest, and how strong is that interest? The analysis is, how much does this search advance that interest? And in light of all of the other sweeping conditions and restrictions to which HR is subject through PSL and Megan's Law, I think the answer to that is, well, only incrementally. It only advances the interest quite so much, but that advancement is greatly outweighed by the degree of intrusion here.
Intrusion on a Tier 3 offender who's on parole supervision for life, who has virtually no protections, right to privacy, whatever, and until and unless he actually violates, commits another crime, there is no law enforcement anything. It's purely deterrence.
He does have a right to privacy.
No, I didn't say he didn't have any. He had very, very restricted movement. And I think Justice Albin's referring to the fact limited places where he can work, places where he's going to be under severe scrutiny. They can go knock on his front door any day of the week and say, I hear you've been hanging out at the school. But they can't tell whether he has been during the day or not to make sure he doesn't, to prevent him from perhaps assaulting another child or kidnapping another child. In other words, we're not talking about the DUI checkpoint, which can stop you or me, who's never been a violator, who has no history, who has no nothing, stop us, pull us over, breath test us, and lock us up for DUI without any suspicion, and the entire general public, who has complete freedom of movement, is now searched, and that's okay. Or the DNA, that is purely law enforcement. There's no deterrent purpose. But DNA is purely for that investigative purpose, but that's limited intrusion, but it's permissible.
So there's a lot to unpack here.
You're telling me.
So I just want to go back, because this has been the premise of some of Your Honor's questions.
That's my first question.
Questions, Justice Patterson. When I began to talk about the City of Indianapolis case, I did so to point out that what was being argued there by the government was that it's so important. It's so such an important policy to eradicate illicit drug activity in the city of Indianapolis that we must be permitted to stop every vehicle and search it for drugs. The Supreme Court said, quote, "There's no doubt that traffic in illegal narcotics creates a social harm of the first magnitude, but the gravity of the threat alone cannot be dispositive of questions concerning what means law enforcement officers may employ to pursue that goal."
Yeah,
then
so
they go on.
First purpose was drug interdiction. Second purpose is if we find somebody impaired, we keep them.
Then they go on to say the reason this can't be a special needs here search here, folks, is because the means by which law enforcement goes about eradicating illicit drugs is not divorced from law enforcement purposes. It's not divorced from evidence gathering.
So Justice Albin gave you the example of the drug test.
Right.
That's, I think, a very strong analogy to this.
So
would you make the same arguments for no more drug testing?
No, I wouldn't. And here's why. So the current framework for, let's just look at traditional parolees, okay? A person on parole, traditional parole, who's been released from prison for a CDS crime, he's entitled, he will be drug tested, as you say, Justice Albin, and that is a search. It is a search. But by the same token, that person is also entitled to reasonable suspicion before his home is searched, his car is searched, his person is searched, any other effect is searched. And so I point this out to say, whatever the answer is, and maybe I don't know it, but whatever the answer is for why we make suspicion in that case for searches of those, the homes and persons, why you need it there but not for the drug case, for drug testing,
but you're making
that's
my
the
point.
Reason that would apply
that's
here.
Not,
you're
that's not
you're
the
making my point. You're talking about balancing. You cite the Indiana case and other cases that there are cases where they're conducting a search of a person moving freely on the street, not a parolee, not a Tier 3 parolee. It's a very limited, and the whole state of New Jersey, as recently as we could check, I think there were 80 of them. The most dangerous, the most likely to recidivate, sex offenders, that limited class, under this circumstance, not you or me walking down the street or driving our car on the highway, the balancing tests that you're giving us, where the U.S. Supreme Court went one way, are it a different world from what we're talking
about
only, here.
First
very
of all,
different test.
Right. First of all, we
you
don't,
said, right?
For the sake of argument, I discussed this in my brief, and I'm here to do that today, but I don't think we get to the balancing test because of what we're talking about, Justice Patterson, which is if the means by which the deterrence is effectuated involves classic law enforcement's evidence gathering, which this does, then we don't get there.
No, but,
so
it, doesn't, but there. It doesn't until the offense is committed.
No.
To the extent that it deters, like you see the checkpoint, you don't drink and drive. To the extent that it deters for all of those individuals that aren't showing up on the surveys or the checks or the whatever to look at the stats, it's deterrent. They never get investigated. Law enforcement doesn't get involved except to the extent the parolee's officer is involved every day anyway. Until there's an offense, there is no law enforcement activity beyond the parole supervision.
But you're the underlying premise of your question, Your Honor, is that the GPS data can only be used to prosecute crimes in the long run, right? So like comparing and contrasting the data to previous sex crimes. They use it for something more immediate. And so that's in the record.
Crimes committed.
That's in the record in this case. So like to give you an answer, so HR in this case was wearing the GPS device. His parole officer suspected that he crossed over the Ben Franklin Bridge to go to Philadelphia, and a buzzer and alert went off immediately.
It didn't deter him.
Right.
He committed the offense.
Well, no, he didn't commit the offense.
No, I know. It was a
false alarm. Yeah. But the point being, if he did go over the bridge, and the only evidence of that would have been the GPS data, he would have been prosecuted for a third-degree crime.
But he wasn't because he didn't offend, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. If they don't offend, and it does have the deterrent effect, there is no law enforcement involvement.
So let's just say that I'm wrong, that the evidence gathering doesn't actually put teeth into the deterrent effect of this. And this is only about deterrence, and that's all it does. We then go to the balancing test, right?
Why do you say it's only about deterrence? Where do we start to divine the purpose of the statute?
Well, I think you would start in the enabling statute, the findings and declarations of the legislature.
Right.
I think the best evidence, though, Your Honor,
what
of that...
What does that assert? Look at B.
Right. So behavioral control. That's the closest thing we get to deterrence. Okay.
Rehabilitation and safety.
Behavioral control, right. But if you go to the next part, so 123.91, or that's the definition, excuse me, if you go to 92, this is the meat of the program. This tells you how the program works, and this is about the collection data. And this goes back to what we've been talking about with Justice Patterson, which is, right, the way that they effectuate the behavioral control is by gathering evidence.
Okay, so the parole board, parole officer calls him in and asks him, did you venture into Pennsylvania today? Doesn't have to give Miranda warnings, correct? Doesn't have to, right?
I would say that he does.
Okay.
This court has never had to opine to that, but okay. I would say it does because it's asking him if he committed a crime.
Let's say he doesn't.
Okay.
Okay, but that would be like a natural question. Like, what have you done today? Well, I decided to go on a shopping spree in Philadelphia. Can he be charged?
Yes, he could be. If he incriminates
himself.
That's
evidence gathering, no? The whole purpose of parole is evidence gathering. The parole officer wants to make certain that the parolee is in compliance with the terms of his parole. Their job is to gather evidence to make certain that's happening. Am I crazy about that?
No, I mean, that's part of the purpose. But in your hypothetical, if the parolee came to the office, did go to Philadelphia, came to the office and said, no, I didn't go there. I was in my home the entire time.
Okay. And if the parole officer wound up calling up the mother and several other people and found that he was there, he'd be charged.
Yes, he would. And he'd also be charged if they look at the evidence that they're garnering from the GPS device.
But tell me if I'm mistaken. One of the central purposes of the parole officer is to ensure that this Tier 3 offender is in compliance with the terms of his parole, correct?
Yes.
One of the purposes, or maybe the central purpose, of the electronic monitoring is to ensure that the Tier 3 offender is in compliance with the conditions of his parole. Am I correct about that?
Yes, you're correct about that.
I'll express to you one of my concerns.
Okay.
And that is over the period of time, like years, this type of search, this monitoring, remaining in place. So I want to ask you a question about that.
Right.
Can your client get off of his Tier 3 offender status?
No.
Okay, so what you're saying is he's not only going to be tied to this electronic monitoring on the day he leaves. It could be 30 years later.
Until he dies.
Okay.
And the reason is that what makes him a Tier 3 registrant, based on a completely unvalidated scale, it's not scientifically validated, is static criteria, which can never change.
So it seems to me, I'm going to throw this out, that you have an argument, some sort of argument, that at some point in the continuum, the continued monitoring process becomes unreasonable, maybe even irrational. And even if you're using the special needs, the government's right, the nature of the intrusion, that balancing may change over time, provided that the offender is offense-free for like a number of years.
Yes, I think that that's exactly right. I think that as time goes by, the balancing test becomes more acute, if you will.
But your argument here is the whole thing should go out.
Yes,
you're arguing very clearly for GPS monitoring to be unconstitutional.
Let me just ask you a question, because I don't know. Did you just say that the entire tiering system is based on inaccurate data and it's invalid?
Correct. This court has said that. This court had said that this is an unscientific instrument. It's not empirical based at all. It's nothing but a useful tool.
Tool we use every day to determine these tiers. Every judge that makes does it. Has any challenge been made to this? That I'm not.
Yeah, there's a challenge right now in the appellate division with respect to using this tool to adjudge internet-based crimes and just those alone.
But nothing else. Just limit it to that.
No. There's been challenges over the years about each of the factors or criteria on the scale.
There have been challenges to the reliability of the evidence.
Right. There was a main challenge in this. It was in re CA from this
right.
court.
Yeah.
And this court said, you know what? It's not scientifically based. It's not based on empirical evidence, but
that's
what
stays.
It is. You,
but
everyone
it stays.
Uses it.
Court yeah. didn't express it with that kind of a tone, though. So.
Not quite. No, they didn't. But
not
can
quite.
I remember that case.
Right.
Otherwise, we'd be saying it is what it is for every case.
So, but Your Honor's question, so, but this isn't, though, keep in mind, this is not an equal protection argument, in which case I'm saying the SOMA surveillance creates a distinct class of defendants and treats them more poorly than any other defendant, and that's not rationally related to a government purpose. I'm not making that argument. And the underlying premise of your question about the more the time goes by, the more unreasonable, that question has more relationship to that kind of argument.
That would be a
due process
challenge down the road,
right.
maybe equal protection,
correct.
Whatever.
I mean, but Justice
That's
Alvin
not...
is correct, though, in that it does bear on the balancing test to some degree. But again, and this was something that was brought up by you, Justice Solomon, you mentioned O'Hagan, and so if you recall, when I first started, I said there's four reasons why this can't be a special needs search for which no suspicion is required.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth reason was that this court has drawn a clear line of demarcation between special needs searches that don't need suspicion and those that do, and the line of demarcation is whether or not it could result in penal consequences. There is only one outlier to that test, that synthesization there, and that's O'Hagan. O'Hagan is the only case, the only one from this court or the United States Supreme Court in which you allowed a search to be conducted
I wasn't on the court yet.
Under the special needs analysis with no suspicion, even though it could result in penal consequences.
And also exoneration.
Correct. But the difference, though, why I point this out and that outlier case is that what distinguishes the case at bar from O'Hagan is two things. One, O'Hagan only dealt with the long-range penal consequences. Long-range is the word that Justice Wallace used. He said, yeah, you know, we get the DNA data, and you can compare that to unresolved crimes, but that's long-term. That's long-term. Here, we do have the long-term criminal liability detection, but we also have the more immediate short-term one. This is what we were talking about earlier with using the GPS data to see if someone traveled out of state. That's immediate. That's the short-term. What also distinguishes it, too, is the degree of intrusion.
But,
I mean,
but the
that
reality,
was
I mean, the focus here is on potentially, the focus of your presentation is on potentially matching it up with a crime. Not talking about crossing into...
Not necessarily, no.
Well,
I mean, that's a third-degree
crime,
matching that. Yeah.
If you take the potential for new sex offenses and the deterrent effect of being potentially matched up with those new sex offenses, what's the difference between that and the DNA situation in O'Hagan? The DNA, as I read O'Hagan, the DNA can be used, goes into a CODIS, it can be used over time to match
so
the cold cases.
There is a similarity. I will concede that, but there also is a difference in that even the long-range consequences is different because with the DNA, that evidence is just, it's warehouse. Nothing is done with it. Here, the evidence is constantly correlated to unresolved sex crimes.
So is DNA.
Contemporaneous
so
to when
DNA.
It's being generated.
So is DNA.
Well, but
how many past old crimes are resolved because of DNA taken today?
But what I'm saying is the moment that the geographic whereabouts comes through to the parole board, the moment that's happening, contemporaneous to where the parolee is, that's automatically being compared and contrasted to old sex crimes.
And maybe,
I'm not so sure is the case with DNA.
But DNA, the CODIS would provide a match over time if DNA on a victim is
time.
Found.
But
I mean, this may be a faster kind of matching that could,
right.
But the same process occurs in both.
But as I said, the way to, there I can see there are some similarities, but the difference is the degree of intrusion, you know, a buccal swab versus, I mean, I don't know how else to call it. This is a modern-day ball and chain that generates data. That's what it is.
But the parole office, tell me if I'm mistaken. Let's say there are crimes committed, sex crimes, within a particular town in which the Tier 3 offender lives. The parole officer can ask him, where were you at 10 a.m., 11 a.m., 12 p.m.? All permissible, correct?
Correct.
In order to determine whether he was anywhere near the scene of the crime. Those will all be permissible questions, correct?
Right, they would be.
Those are not unfair intrusions, correct? Their right to know where he is at every minute of the day, correct?
Well, I mean, yeah, they can.
Okay, so my question to you is, the electronic monitoring is just a better way of doing that, no?
No.
I was wondering what you conceded that question.
It's more than that, and this is a point I did want to make. So when we talk about the DI versus the GI, it's not just the information, the geographic whereabouts that the data reveals, which is similar to Your Honor's question. You're right. It's more than that. Right. It's the physical discomfort, pain, and frankly, injury that this causes. That's part of the analysis when it comes to the degree of intrusion. And that's been a bone of contention in the courts below. The Attorney General has always said, it does cause all that. They didn't dispute those facts on summary judgment that the device actually physically digs into the ankle of HR. They just said, that's not part of search and seizure analysis. That's ex post facto. That's wrong. That is very much part of the degree of intrusion here. And we know that from a long line of cases from the U.S. Supreme Court. And in fact, in U.S. versus Jones in 2012, Justice Scalia, writing for the majority, he actually clarified this point. He said, you know, ever since Justice Harlan came up with the reasonable expectation of privacy standard in search and seizure law in his concurring opinion, we've kind of glommed on to that. But historically, the Fourth Amendment in our Constitution was more than that. It was about the trespass on the person. You have a right to be left alone from the government. And so the fact that this device is intruding on the person's body, that's part of the analysis.
You know, the right to let alone doesn't apply to people who are on parole, okay? We're not letting alone those people.
You know that for
people who are under PSL, there are 26 different conditions, including potential curfew and every sort of other type of intrusion, including drug testing, so on and so forth, no?
Well,
very diminished right of privacy. This is what Justice Solomon was getting.
But they still have a right. They still have the right to first have reasonable suspicion before any search. And if HR were not on parole, the debate wouldn't be reasonable suspicion or no reasonable suspicion. It would be they need a warrant supported by probable cause. It's only by virtue of him being on parole and subject to all those conditions. Do we even get to the reasonable suspicion?
We'll never get to the reason. You know, and this, you're a very fine advocate, that in these cases, it would be impossible to determine reasonable suspicion. Because if we knew that a Tier 3 offender, there was a reasonable suspicion that he's about to commit an offense, we're going to curfew that person, or we would try to violate his parole.
They do it now. Part of PSL involves...
You want us to find that in order to conduct any form of electronic monitoring, that there has to be a finding by a court that there's a reasonable suspicion he's about to go out and commit a crime.
No, I'm not asking for court intervention. The parole board can make that determination for themselves. And if the parolee wants to challenge that, they can do so through the administrative process. They do this now, Justice Albin. This is 72-10.1. Okay, and I'll give you an example. So we have clients on PSL who are not Tier 3 and subject to the surveillance under SOMA, but who are subject to the monitoring device nonetheless because their parole officer has reasonable suspicion that they either just violated a parole condition or will violate one.
So in this setting,
we do it now.
In this setting, what could constitute reasonable suspicion? Let's say it's someone as to whom the concern is children. What could constitute reasonable suspicion that would not be in and of itself, either a violation of parole or a new offense? An attempt to lure? Offense.
But everything
So you're saying we'd have to wait until, and we're talking about, to some extent here, child victims. We have to wait until either there's child pornography, there's an attempt to get a kid into a car, whatever it may be. We have to wait until that happens with a real live victim out there in order to have reasonable suspicion, and beyond that, you can't do the monitoring.
Gravity of the harm alone, Your Honor,
cannot be
dispositive as to the search. This is search and seizure jurisprudence.
I understand that. I'm not confusing that. Trust me. I'm not confusing that. What is the effect, what is the reasonable suspicion that could exist without either a VOP or a new offense,
okay,
or an attempt?
I'll give you a real life hypothetical, okay? So PSL parolee has a ban on living with his ex-girlfriend. You know, parole officer says, I don't want you living with her for reasons X, Y, and Z, okay? Parole officer suspects that that parolee went and visited that woman at her home. He then puts a GPS device, his reasonable suspicion now, to believe that he violated that condition. He then places the GPS device to ensure and generate evidence of that parolee visiting that woman. That's a real life hypothetical scenario, and that took place under the context of 72-101, which is the regulation that allows the parole board to conduct these searches pursuant to reasonable suspicion.
What was
they
the basis for the reasonable suspicion in your hypothetical? Somebody told him?
Truthfully, as I stand here now, I don't remember exactly what the reasonable suspicion was. I do know, and this is a Burlington County case, that my client's parole officer suspected that he was going to the home when he shouldn't. He didn't have proof. He suspected. I don't know the reason. And so he implemented the GPS device.
Justice Patterson's question, as I understood it, was how much do you need in order to establish reasonable suspicion, and how far short of that is from proof of the actual offense itself? And that's why I'm asking you, what was the core?
Okay, and that's a fair question. And truthfully, I don't know what the core is. But I think the answer is no more or no less than the reasonable, articulable suspicion that's part and parcel to everything we do in the criminal justice system.
So how can you deter the crime? You can't. You take away the deterrent effect if what you say is you cannot do the GPS monitoring unless there's already reasonable suspicion. So as long as the person goes out there, lures the child into the car, commits the crime without some sort of other extrinsic evidence coming into the parole officer, then you've never had reasonable suspicion and you can't prevent that crime.
So if reasonable suspicion exists that the parolee is loitering about a schoolyard, well, then the GPS device is implemented, generates the data, the evidence, and that works as a deterrent.
We keep talking about what
can a parole officer do, what can he do. We're missing one side of the balancing test here, which is the degree of intrusion. And again, it's not just the whereabouts that's being generated, it's the actual trespass on the body. And so I cited to Jones, but the better example perhaps is even the blood draw line of cases, Schmerber and McNeely. And so when the U.S. Supreme Court said that you need probable cause before you conduct a blood draw, they weren't so concerned with the person's blood type. It was that they have a right not to have a needle jab in their arm,
except when they're on parole. You have conceded that all that can be done without suspicion. That's the difference between being a free agent in society and having conditional liberty on parole.
They don't need probable cause as they did in Schmerber. They need something less by virtue of their PSL status, that being reasonable suspicion.
You may be required, if you have a drug problem, you can be required to come in on a monthly basis and have a drug draw without any suspicion, correct?
Well, I don't know, frankly, whether they draw in that manner, in that degree of intrusion.
Or a urine test, or whatever.
But this gets back to your question earlier, which is, okay, this constitutional law from this court that parolees and probationers are entitled to reasonable suspicion. We know that. So, and yet we don't require that when it comes to just routine drug testing to make parole workable. We don't require that. So whatever the answer is for that would apply here. I would suspect that it's the degree of intrusion, but whatever the reason is for why we allow drug testing in parole, but demand reasonable suspicion for the search of a parolee's home, whatever that reason is, answers your Honor's question. Again, I don't know it. I suspect it's the degree of intrusion.
Can I ask you something I think you know, and the prosecutors will know it. I know. I used to know. Is GPS applicable to all Tier 3 offenders?
Yes.
So if you're Tier 3, you're going to be on GPS.
Yes.
Excuse me. If you're on PSL, however, that's a parole board determination. Correct?
Correct.
Some are on, some are off.
Correct.
I guess it would have to be, what's the correlation between Tier 3 and PSL? I assume all PSLs are not Tier 3, but all Tier 3s are PSL.
Not necessarily.
No, if they
committed there's some, a long there's some time, offenses right. that trigger only Megan's Law and not PSL.
Okay.
So Daddy, can I ask you to, after Justice Lavecchia's question, wrap up your argument?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, yes. One last question about PSL. As I read 123.91, he can't come off PSL, correct?
That's correct.
And is that because of the kind of offense he was convicted of?
No, it's because PSL is presumptively...
Forever.
Forever. For life.
And there's no behavioral mechanism that gets one off that anymore.
Correct. Well, I mean, he can apply. I will clarify. He can apply to be taken off of PSL after 15 years of remaining offense-free, but it's a very high hurdle to overcome. It's clear and convincing evidence. So there is a mechanism for it, but it's meant to be for life, as the name implies.
So this intense monitoring that we're talking about is for all intents and purposes, unless one can meet that standard you're describing, permanent.
Correct.
Okay.
There are certain people in the G category who are on for life. There is no 15-year look back, correct?
That's correct. G subsection G
well, that's
does
what
not
I'm getting
apply to
at.
PSL.
There is a category of person who cannot get off.
Of parole supervision for life?
Yes. I thought there was.
Yes, there is.
No, not necessarily. So if you're on PSL, the escape valve is remain crime-free.
Yes.
The legislature used the word crime.
Okay.
Crime-free for 15 years, and then you can apply to be taken off, to be released.
Okay.
There's no offense-based bars to getting off like there is in Megan's Law.
Right. The G is registration.
Correct.
Got
right.
it.
So to
wouldn't the monitor help with a clear convincing argument?
I'm sorry, pardon?
Wouldn't the monitor help with a clear convincing argument? You can show that you've done nothing for 15 years, that you've been home free. Or GPS, I'm sorry, the GPS monitor. Wouldn't that help with the clear and convincing standard to get off PSL? By being able to show from the data that you've done nothing wrong, you haven't been near any schools, you haven't crossed the city,
well,
state
I mean,
lines. Hey, wouldn't that help?
Perhaps. I can tell you that the GPS parolee population would just assume take their chances on that application without the 15 years of GPS data. So in closing, I just want to say one thing. So Justice Lavecchia, you wrote a dissenting opinion in Joy versus Hunterdon Central School Board. And you started your dissenting opinion with a very powerful statement, which was this. In my view, the majority's application of the special needs doctrine to support the school drug testing program at issue here seriously erodes the traditional jurisprudential analysis governing searches and seizures. Why that is so apropos to this case is because that's essentially what the state is asking you to do, which is erode all of the procedures, all the criteria that's been in place for searches of parolees and for special needs searches.
But these parolees are being reintegrated into society. That's the purpose of SOMA and the statute. It's to make sure that they do not reoffend. And at the end of 15 years, without reoffending, they can apply. I mean, there is a public safety portion of SOMA that the legislature underscored here. And one of the things that a parolee has to recognize is that they're on parole. They've been given a chance to step out into the sunlight and live their life with certain restrictions. SOMA is one of those restrictions.
The degree of intrusion, as we've been discussing, to the parolee significantly outweighs any incremental advancement that the surveillance has to that reintegration. But also, they don't have a choice. New Jersey is the only state, I'm almost positive of this, that has something called PSL. No other state has this. And so, you know, when other states, so in California, they can, unlike here in New Jersey, in California, they permit their parole board to search parolees without any suspicion whatsoever. The reason is that on a condition of parole, of getting out of prison early, is that you'll acquiesce to a search without suspicion. Parolees here don't have that choice.
I have a question. This is informational. Can a Tier 3 offender, even though while he is on PSL, can he apply to the chairman of the parole board or the parole board to be taken off electronic monitoring based upon positive conduct over a period of time?
No. His only a Tier 3 offender like HR, his only recourse is to go back to the trial court, the Megan's Law judge, in this case in Cumberland County, and argue why that Tier 3 classification is wrong, despite his presumptively accurate RRAS score.
Okay, assuming the person is Tier 3, and it's, the numbers are static,
yeah,
they're not going to change, is there still a safety valve that permits you to argue to the trial court you shouldn't be Tier 3?
Yeah, so there's the this court in INRI GB in 2001 said the risk scale is presumptively accurate. It should be used in every case, but in a very unusual case, sufficiently unusual case, for which evidence exists that the scale does not account, you can argue that your risk of reoffense falls outside the heartland of typical tier three cases. But it's a very rare case, and so for all intents and purposes, his Tier 3 classification will forever remain in place.
What about the 15 years? I'm sorry. He's no look back.
This is the last question,
I'm
and then
sorry.
We're going to move on to another.
As a matter of fact, skip us.
I'm sorry, Justice Patterson. Yeah. Do you want me to answer this,
yes,
Your Honor?
Please.
What was the question?
Does he have the ability to go after 15 years with clear and convincing evidence to convince a judge that he should no longer be on PSL?
That depends on the interpretation of – it depends on a lot of things. That's the best answer. The reason I say that is because even if it's been 15 years since his – well, I suppose he would, because his crime was not barred by subsection G. So that
right.
may
so
be
So he's
possible.
Not a subsection G.
No, luring or enticing.
So to say it's forever is really a maybe.
G. Well, yeah, I say it's forever because this court has always said it's presumptively for life.
Mr. Duddy, thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court, I'd like to make 2 points and then clarify, I think, the point that you're just struggling over right now. But the first is the point that I briefed, which is special needs searches are a subset of searches, of all searches. And suspicionless special needs searches are an even smaller subset. And there is a precondition to get to suspicionless searches that has been true in every single suspicionless search case decided by this court or the United States Supreme Court. Every single one has held that the search involved was minimal. Now, let me be clear. The ACLU of New Jersey doesn't accept in many of those cases that the search was minimal. We thought DNA testing was more invasive. We thought suspicionless drug testing of high school students was more invasive. But the court said the search involved is minimal. So if the court were to allow suspicionless GPS searching, searching of the home, it would be unprecedented, never before done by this court or the United States Supreme Court in a special needs search analysis, ever.
Why is that a threshold question as opposed to a factor to consider?
Because that's how the cases are written. If you read Skinner, which was the first case to allow a suspicionless search, it said when the search involved is minimal, we can engage
right.
in this balance.
But look at those, that line of cases, Skinner, we're dealing with what train conductors.
Correct.
They are free agents in society, okay, who are entitled to the entire panoply of liberty rights. We're dealing with a different class over here, people who have conditional liberty rights, and when it comes to a Tier 3 offender, really minimal conditional. So shouldn't we be weighing the different classifications when we're talking about whether or not the intrusion could be minimal or more than minimal?
Well, to be clear, Skinner dealt with people who were free and at liberty, but Griffin
yeah.
dealt with probationers, right? So, and even there, the court didn't allow for suspicionless searches. This is always that they can go into your home, that they know whether you're going to a gay bar or where you go to worship or whether you're going to an abortion clinic. There is real, they say, well, sure, they know you're going to a pharmacy, but maybe you were just going to pick up some Advil. Right, but if you go to an abortion clinic, there's less gray area. If you go to a gay bar, maybe they make the best martini, but probably that's not why you're there. So there's really deeply personal information that is revealed to the government here, and that is true whether you're talking about probationers, parolees, or people who are free and at liberty. And in some ways, parolees, and particularly when we're talking about tier three sex offenders, they're the canaries in the coal mine.
What strikes me as this being not minimal is that the government's asserting a need to monitor. But this monitoring is unlike any monitoring that's been done before of this category of individual, and we'll call them parolees. It is constant, it is intense, and it is unending, as far as I can tell, which is why I was asking the questions before about whether there is any way in which an individual can get themselves off of this. So as a result of viewing this new, intense, constant, deeply personal monitoring of an individual, I feel like I'm in a balancing test. I know you and your co-counsel are arguing that this is not special needs setting at all. That may go more to whether or not it's done for law enforcement purposes or not. But within the balancing test, do you agree that those concerns that I have should be evaluated against government's asserted need to monitor?
Yes.
Okay.
And so let me say this. As you indicate, we think it's a precondition. But assume it's not a precondition and simply part of the balancing.
Mm-hmm.
I think then, if you're going to say, let's just look at the marginal imposition this is on a Tier 3 offender compared to all the other impositions on his liberty, you also have to look at the benefit to the government as the marginal benefit when compared with the benefit of what they all the information they can already get.
There's no question that this is a search.
That's been decided.
That's beside it.
But my point is this. This gets to my second point, so let me maybe make the second point and then try and tie it together. Page 12 of the state's brief, the state says, when we talk about the government interest, that's whatever the legislature says, and it's insulated from judicial review. It evades judicial review, according to the state. So if they say there are these crazy high recidivism rates among sex offenders, despite evidence that that data is incorrect, the data which, to be fair, has been cited by this court, cited by the United States Supreme Court, but now with hindsight we know is wrong, their point is you can't even look at that. We just get to, if the legislature says it, you must accept it.
No, but you know you can, look, you know you can challenge that. You've challenged legislative presumptions before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we knocked out the G provision for juveniles, but it was based upon a record. It was based upon testimony, expert witnesses, so that we were able to determine whether or not the classification as applied to juveniles was no longer rational.
Justice Alvin, to be clear, I'm not asking the court to strike down the statute based on new data. What I'm saying is the state says you can't even look at it. What the legislature says goes, and I just want to point out what that would mean.
So let me ask you a question. Because this court has already made certain exceptions even for the tiering, when you can get off the tiering. Those are judicially created exceptions, correct?
Yes.
So if there was judicial review over the length of period of the electronic monitoring, weighing the intrusion over a period of time versus the governmental benefit, would that allay your concerns?
No, because as I said, I believe it's not a minimal search, and it's a threshold question. In the balancing, would that be better? Of course. That gets me to the clarification I want to make, and then I'll try and tie it all together. You asked Mr. Duddy whether his client could get off of Tier 3, and his answer was no, because the factors are static. If you read the state's brief, they're very clear that people have gotten off of Tier 3. I want to suggest to this court that those two things are not in conflict. For Mr. Duddy's client, his basis for being on Tier 3 is because of static factors, which won't change. So if you run the risk assessment after 5 years of good behavior, he'll still be Tier 3. That doesn't mean that no one can get off. It means his client is compelled to be on Tier 3 for life.
Aren't most Tier 3 people in that same setting because
yes.
The static factors are looking at a history of adjudications that put them there?
They are.
Okay.
They are. And so I just want to be clear here that if we're saying, okay, this Tier 3 offenders only have this additional burden on them of wearing this uncomfortable thing that's a scarlet letter and all the things that we've said in Riley and elsewhere. And maybe they can't go camping because they need to charge it and they can't do all sorts of other things. That's fine to say we only are going to look at the marginal difference, but then we also have to look at all the things that they can do. They can drug test. But incidentally, I don't think they could do a blood draw of parolees. I think Rovoto talks about that. So maybe they could do urinalysis because our courts have said that testing for drugs through urine is a minimal intrusion. But they haven't said that about blood draws. That's a maximum intrusion. So by the logic of this, if the court accepts the state's logic, we would say they could also blood draw parolees willy-nilly when they wanted to without any suspicion.
You know, you mentioned the incremental value to the state. If the state's, the legislature's apparent interest in this is that this prevents victims from being victimized, that there's a deterrent effect, and someone may think, and there's a sort of a sense here that the very act of controlling one's impulses because of a concern about the ramifications of reoffending isn't in fact rehabilitative. But for whatever reason, that person may not offend because of the GPS monitoring. That's the theory, as I read it in the statute and very much reflected by the state. How could you ever measure that deterrent effect? In other words, I know we all look for data, but the data will not show that that's the reason why the offense didn't happen.
So I'm not a statistician.
I understand.
I'm going to start with that
important
caveat. But I think you could still do longitudinal analyses of two different populations who have the same risk scores, some of whom, maybe it's New Jersey and another state that doesn't allow it.
Maybe.
I suspect
maybe.
It is
but what
a
I'm
measurable
saying is that
thing.
If what they're saying this statute accomplishes is true to some extent, then offenses are not happening, a good thing from the state's perspective, right?
From all of our
society's
sure.
perspective. And that's a really difficult thing for the state to come forward with data measuring the beneficial effect of the data. There are many things the state is expected to prove with data. This is one that may be impossible to prove with data because, good thing, the offenses are not occurring.
So, Justice Patterson, to that point, I would just say that might be true. I don't pretend to have enough knowledge to know whether it's provable or not provable, but what I do know is that if it's not provable, the state can come forward and say, this is simply unprovable and explain why it's unprovable. But that's not the tack they've taken. Instead, they've said, we never have to prove it.
I understand. What I've been hearing from this, the briefs, reading the briefs from you and your colleagues is, and particularly the defense brief, is there's minimal, this is having a minimal effect, incremental maybe. There's really nothing to back that up or refute it.
So I'm not taking a position on what the rigorous analysis would show. I'm simply saying if a registrant wants to make that case, they should be entitled to, and there shouldn't be some insulation from judicial review. I don't know what the case would be.
Mr. Schlum, in your knowledge of special needs cases, generally in New Jersey and elsewhere, are you aware of any other special need case that has had to analyze on a special need basis an intrusion on someone's privacy as a search outside of a temporal setting? Because I could not come up with one.
Right.
Every other search that has been used as a special need search has a temporal nature to it. This seems to not, and I don't, but I don't know if I've exhaustively thought of everything that I should be thinking of.
So I can't think of any. I think the closest would be, I guess, the employment-based drug testing, that as long as you're employed as a trained
conductor.
But
those conductor. Are infrequent random testing. Each test is points in time. It's not constant.
Of course, but it doesn't have a definite terminus like being a high school student does for most high school students.
Right. Not just a
right.
Solomon.
Right.
I wasn't
there was no
there.
End to high school.
But
10
I mean,
years is not forever.
Right.
But wait a minute. I want you to focus on the search itself. The search is the act of taking something from someone or invading someone's privacy at the moment you're conducting the search. I've not come into another special ed setting like this that the state is asserting fits a special needs setting.
Whereas this is, it's not just that this is lifetime, but it's that it's constant.
Yes.
I think that's a critical distinction, and that goes to the question of whether it's minimal, whether that's viewed as a threshold question or as part of the balancing, it weighs very heavily in the invasiveness that this is constant. And I think there's a minimization about what a big deal it is. And we, Justice Alvin, you talked about the scarlet letter. It's true, we have some pretrial detainees who are now on GPS monitoring. Assigning more people the scarlet letter doesn't make its ignominy less. It's just a big deal for a lot of people. It's true, some are sex offenders and some are pretrial detainees, but no one wears GPS monitors.
I don't think anyone's minimizing the huge consequence or invasiveness or burden that's placed on those who have to wear these monitoring devices.
Okay, good. I think, to me, that ends the inquiry. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kinney.
Chief Justice, Associate Justices, I really don't need to piggyback much on what co-counsel has said. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the court might have. I will say just a couple things. As far as, again, with the special needs search, there has been nothing like this in New Jersey, and it seems to me from the cases in New Jersey that this would go so above and beyond, again, the temporal nature of the other special needs searches that we have. As far as the GPS, again, we're talking about constant supervision for what could be, at a minimum, 15 years, could be much longer than that. So these people are getting out of prison, and then they have this thing on their leg for as long as possibly, you know, some, again, could be forever. The other thing that I wanted to just comment on what Mr. Duddy said was, you know, the state says, well, people can change their tiers. It's not that simple. It's not that easy. There's factors that are static that will never change. And then there's factors that, you know, could be involved with hearsay, or there could be individuals who they weren't charged, but they'll use it against them in the tiering process. And I'm not saying that the tiering process is invalid. It's obviously valid. It's used by the courts as a tool. But there's situations where it's antisocial acts. That could be anything that they do that is used against them. They don't need proof. It's not beyond reasonable doubt. It's clear and convincing evidence. And they use it against them. And you have a situation where someone is a tier three where, you know, could be borderline. As far as anything else, any other questions I'll have, again, I know the court's time is limited. I don't want to belabor any points.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Schuster.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm essentially going to waive my opening because we're tight on time and it's getting late. We ask that this court find that the 24-hour GPS monitoring of the Tier 3 offenders under SOMA is a lawful special needs search. There's no improper law enforcement purpose here. Looking at all of the evidence, as the courts are instructed to do, and going to the legislative findings and declarations, first of all, there's more than just deterrence here. But deterrence alone is not an improper law enforcement purpose. But there's a real special need here in allowing the public to protect itself and to protect its children. And O'Hagan is very instructive. I mean, when looking at the plain language of the statute, the DNA statute that this court was looking at in O'Hagan and talking about, there's a lot of things in that statute talking about, you know, law enforcement, how things are helpful to law enforcement, and that was not dispositive of the special needs analysis. The court found very specifically that although there's some incidental benefit to law enforcement in being able to ultimately prosecute, that public safety is much broader than prosecuting individual defendants.
Is there a need for a certain level of judicial review to keep this GPS monitoring program within certain constitutional limitations? And I'm speaking in terms of length of time and the balancing. Like, it's hard, I think, to argue that this is a minimal intrusion. 24 hours, this thing attached to your body wherever you go, all of the things that have already been spoken to. Like 10, 15, I'm giving extremes here, 10, 15 years out where the person is offense free. If we're engaged in some sort of balancing, wouldn't that seem to be extreme or maybe even irrational?
Well,
go ahead.
As is discussed here, previously, there is an opportunity at 15 years to come off of PSL. And so the way that, to the extent that your privacy isn't invaded to the level of a parolee who's on PSL, the appellate division here,
I'm not thinking about the 15-year, because that's a legislative. We've created judicial exceptions in the hearing process, correct? Those are judicial exceptions. Am I correct about that?
Yes.
So why couldn't this court do a similar, require a similar type of monitoring so that there isn't excessive use of GPS, beyond which it can no longer can be justified?
I think the point here is that by tethering it to being a Tier 3 offender, there's already ongoing judicial review and due process. Someone who's a registrant, there's no limitation on the number of times that they can file a change in circumstances, challenge to their tiering, and they can get a public defender to do it if they need
for those who are statically stuck at a level Tier 3, maybe you'll know this. Statistically, how often can a person get off of the Tier 3 offending, Tier 3 status? When you can't get your number down below the level into the second degree mode. Go ahead.
I know anecdotally from the report and what was testified to and to the legislature is that in the pilot program of 225 people in the two-year program, we know 22 people came off of being Tier 3 offenders. I know anecdotally from speaking to Megan's Law prosecutors, this is regularly done, that people that are Tier 3 are challenging, and people are successful when they bring in psychiatrists and psychologists. As this court recognized in GB, the scale, while it's a useful tool, and reiterated that CA in finding that the tool is useful, that it doesn't account for certain things. And also, just in terms of the timing, I want to point out that whereas years ago, it used to be considered that timing factor number, I think it's either 6 or 7 on the for the static factors, that the amount of time that has passed since the last offense, the prevailing belief is that you can get your numbers down, that that's no longer a static factor. And so the first couple, whether it was a child that was involved, in the age of the child, the amount of force used for the crime, how many sexual offenses, those are static. The amount of time that has passed since the offense is not a static factor.
So what if a person perhaps should remain as Tier 3? But this type of intensive, invasive, burdensome monitoring can no longer be justified. There being a distinction between some of the other Tier 3 restrictions as opposed to this. Do you see no distinction that the courts can make or should make?
Because in order to be a Tier 3 offender, and somebody who has moved before the court to amend their tiering or to amend the scope of notification, I suppose it's possible to the extent that you could be a Tier 3 offender but petition to amend the scope of your notification, that it could possibly be something like that. But again, I feel like that's built into, there's so much judicial review that is happening now. Now, in this particular case, HR never participated. It's in the record. He never participated in his tiering. That was the opportunity then to address the static factors in the first instance, waived any opportunity to participate or challenge. Now, on the other hand, to the extent that something were to happen later and somebody came back and said, not in this particular case, and again, it's sealed and I don't have access to what happened, but say there was some inaccuracy on those static factors. Theoretically, the static factors are static and they don't change. But if there was something that was truly inaccurate and somebody brought it to the prosecutor's attention, that would get fixed. That would get adjusted. And the number would be appropriate based on those. But that's such a small number. There's a number of dynamic factors that go into play. And again, the amount of time that has passed and to the extent that someone has been not violating, all of that is taken into account and can be taken into account. Experts can come in, psychologists can come in, and this court recognized in GB that to the extent that something is intrafamilial, there's all these circumstances, and as the research changes, It allows an individualized assessment to continue. And so rather than say this is going to be unconstitutional as to all Tier 3, the legislature has recognized that when somebody has been adjudged Tier 3, that they are an unreasonably high risk to society. Now, to the extent that an individual wants to say, well, all of this time has passed, and look at this research, and look at my psychiatrist, and come in and go before a judge, they get judicial review on that. If they disagree and they feel the judge did not handle their case properly, they can bring their case up to the appellate division. They continue to get judicial review. So the individualized assessment piece stays by tethering it to the Megan's Law Tier 3. You're guaranteed, the individual who's monitored is guaranteed as much ongoing judicial review of their conditions as they would like to see.
Do you have a number? Justice Sala mentioned, looking up some numbers, that there were 80 people involved. Yeah.
Right. So,
the most recent number.
Right. I followed up, and Mr. Josephson followed up with the parole board, and currently it appears that there are, for Tier 3 offenders, that the parole board is doing some sort of supervision of. There's 160 people. 46 of them, I believe, are PSL and 77 are CSL. Now, 30 of the PSLs are pre-SOMA PSLs, and so they're not being monitored. So my understanding...
Wait, say that last 30 part again. 30 of the
70? Only 30 of them are pre-SOMA PSL, so they're not being electronically monitored.
So we're talking about 46 and 47 are the two numbers?
46 and 77.
And
77 on CSL.
But 77, you said 30 are pre-SOMA.
So 30 of the 46 are pre-SOMA. So we're talking about 16 people that are being electronically monitored right now that are mandatory electronic monitoring. That's because of this court with its ruling about ex post facto to ensure that this is a going forward and not a going backward.
So 93?
So 160 total, or does that not add up?
Doesn't add up. 46 minus
30. Oh, it's possible
30.
That there's some Tier 3 people that are neither PSL nor CSL, correct? Or no? No, that the parole board wouldn't be. Again, these are numbers. I think it's 46 and 77 were the numbers, whatever that adds up to. And then this is, I'm sorry, we got these numbers last minute yesterday, yeah. So I'd be nervous about.
But just in general.
Just in 46, general.
46 minus 30. So we'd be saying 16 people, if you're, and we're not holding you to this.
If I think it's 16 people that 16 are being...
16 people plus 77.
What? Well, I think it's 46 PSL, but only 16 are being electronically monitored with GPS.
Yes, 30 were pre-SOMA.
Is it correct that all the tier threes are on GPS? Is that mandatory? I don't remember. It's been a long time.
If you're...
Is it part of Megan's Law? Is
no.
it part of the statute? Tier 3 GPS, is that a statutory provision? Is that a regulation?
SOMA says, part of SOMA says by statute that if you're Tier 3, you will be electronically monitored. Then this court in Riley said it's ex post facto, so you can't be monitoring.
But if you're currently put on Tier 3,
today,
you're on GPS.
Yes.
So you would have to
and PSL.
And PSL. You would have to change your tiering to change your obligation to be on GPS.
You could come off of based on the appellate division's opinion in this case, if you're not on PSL, you don't have the reduced expectation of privacy of being on that kind of intensive parole supervision for life. So if you're on PSL and you're a Tier 3 offender, that those two together equal electronic monitoring.
It's not where I'm going.
If the chairman decides. Right.
Yeah, that's PSL. That's not where I'm going. For PSL, you can go to parole, and you can, and you're not Tier 3. You're PSL. Parole board makes the GPS determination. Correct? I think so.
Under SOMA, there's automatic categorical monitoring. All Tier 3.
Right. PSL, not Tier 3. Parole board makes the decision. PSL, not Tier 3. Parole board makes the determination. Of GPS, I think.
How about this?
If you're on PSL,
I'll tell you what
not,
I'm getting at.
And you're you're Tier 2 and you're on PSL,
right.
The parole board could
makes the call.
Discretionarily call. And then there's a different review process of how often.
Why don't you follow up? with the letter, with the numbers?
With the numbers, yes. I will follow up with the...
Here's what I'm getting.
Wonderful.
I'm glad that the chief has mentioned that, because CSL preceded PSL, so
yes.
I couldn't figure out how you're subtracting 30 from the 46, because...
But those are PSL. Oh, I'm sorry.
You'll follow up, and that would be appreciated.
Yes, I will follow up the numbers.
Let me ask you a different issue.
Yeah.
The board has the authority to share criminal incident information with state and local law state and federal law enforcement authorities. What happens in practice? How is that discretion used?
Well,
how often do they make the referrals?
That I don't have numbers on, but what I do know is what's borne out in this record is that, which doesn't speak directly to that question, but this, I just want to push back on this notion that all parole officers are trying to do is to reincarcerate people. And I think that that's really an unfortunate, they're trying to keep the public safe, and they're trying to keep people on the straight and narrow so that they don't wind up back in jail. And here, in this particular case, when HR, when the parole officer, and this was all in the deposition testimony, had a problem, and apparently the parole officer showed up and said, you know, what's going on? And he said, just handcuff me now or take me back to jail or something like that. He said, what's going on? He said, I used cocaine. And sure enough, his urine came back positive for it. And they didn't violate him for parole. They sent him to get therapy and a Narcotics Anonymous program. They're not trying to just violate people. They're trying to help get them functioning in society and help them out. And certainly to the extent that there is a real problem, they can, or a real danger, they can violate them. But that's not what the goal of parole is. And there really is a rehabilitative piece here. They're trying to, when they found out that when the sensor went off and HR had stepped where they thought was outside of the state line, rather than continue to have a problem, they made sure that the lines were redrawn in the area where he lived so that there wouldn't be a false positive again. So no one is trying to just, these parole officers aren't trying to mess people's lives up and throw them back in jail. They're trying to get them to move forward so that they can be productive members of society and that so people aren't, that there aren't victims on their watch, and that they're helping them sort of function in society.
Let me ask you, just take us, just summarize, see if we're missing anything. The opportunities for judicial intervention. If someone is PSL Tier 3, there are really two that you've identified. One is the 15 years under the statute to be, show by clear and convincing evidence that you're offense-free and convince a judge that you're not a risk under the statute. And the other is the challenge to your tiering, because you're not going to be able to challenge PSL, but you could challenge the tiering, which you mentioned as putting forward both pointing out potential mistakes, showing dynamic factors that may have reduced the risk, and ultimately challenging with assistance of a public defender your tiering. Is that the two opportunities that now exist for judicial intervention?
Yes, and I think that especially the tiering one is ongoing and robust. It's not a, this is one 15-year shot to do something. It's something that continues to go on and on and on, that if you want to file a notice every week, you can. I don't know that that would be particularly helpful.
So it's not like civil commitment where there's 1 year and then you wait another year and then...
People can move to amend the scope of their notification at any time.
And that's based upon our case law, correct?
It's based on the case law, and it's based on the rules that are on the judiciary website,
right,
on this court, the order entered.
They're court-imposed. We could, because of the nature of the burden and intrusiveness, we could, if there was a will, have certain level of judicial review after a period of time that perhaps would be sensible. Would you agree?
I hesitate to say that. I mean, certainly this court could. Whether or not the court needs to, based on the fact that with the Tier 3 piece, that there's already opportunities for judicial review to assess the dangerousness and to allow for all of the information.
In any particular case, it may make sense to have certain tier three restrictions, but maybe not GPS monitoring. That may be too much. No, in a particular case. Instead of having like everything, you got to get off tier three to get off everything. It might be that the most intrusive form of monitoring should receive greater judicial scrutiny. No?
If the court wishes to go in that direction, I think probably attaching it to the scope of notification would be helpful, because that would allow the tier to stay, but the scope of, things like community notification, the court has made the distinction between those two pieces, that the tier can stay, but the scope of notification can be altered.
The statute ties the two together, tier three, GPS, right?
The statute ties
So in order to say not always, there would have to be a finding that the statute was unconstitutional.
Yes, but again, the way the statute allows for it, it appears at first blush to be this categorical blanket rule for all Tier 3 offenders. But again, the only reason you get into Tier 3 in the first instance is because of the individualized assessment, which then has the opportunity for ongoing review.
So tell me if I understand you correctly. You're saying that in light of the fact the statute ties Tier 3 and the GPS monitoring, the way for the judiciary to be involved, short of striking down the statute as unconstitutional, is to be involved with that tiering process. Because if there's no Tier 3, then it's not an automatic GPS.
Right. But the judiciary is already involved
right.
in that tiering
understand
process.
I understand that.
Yeah, it's built into the system as it now stands. In order to find someone Tier 3, there's a recognition that there's been a finding that they are the highest. There's already been a judicial finding that they are the most likely to recidivate. And in Doe, this court recognized that's a very real concern for the community, and that the community needs to be able to act to protect itself and its children.
But to the extent you're defending this practice and this statutory requirement on the basis of special need, you're implicitly acknowledging that there is a balancing that is involved in this review.
Yes, this absolutely, that there is a balancing here. And here, there's the privacy interest that the special need is being balanced against. We're already starting off with a very reduced expectation of privacy. And this is for a group of people that it's not SOMA that's doing it, it's not the GPS monitoring, but it's parole supervision for life, as Your Honors have discussed with counsel. It's a very invasive, very close monitoring. In a lot of ways, as Justice Albin, you were explaining, it's a better version of what the parole officers were doing before, which is very similar to O'Hagan. O'Hagan talks about how when someone has been convicted, you've already taken their picture and you've already taken their fingerprints, and it's taking their DNA is just a better, more accurate version of doing the same thing. And in a lot of ways, this is a better, more accurate version of doing that intensive monitoring. And with PSL, it's not just a matter of the locations. It is
monitoring, but you concede it's a search.
And that's why
you keep funneling it back to special needs, which involves implicitly a balancing of the need for this intensive monitoring at this level that we're talking about against the benefits to be gathered from it.
Oh, yes. At this point, the United States Supreme Court has put to bed. There's no question.
There's no question that we're dealing with a search.
A search.
And the question is, how does it get reviewed and what standards must it meet?
Right. And under the jurisprudence of the United States Supreme Court, and in applying the Fourth Amendment, in Sampson, with parolees, they said that a suspicionless search of someone's person is completely fine. That's not what we have here, and that's to search pockets and to search everything. And in New Jersey,
it's brief, and it's one time, and it's not constant, intense, as we're describing here, is it?
It's not the same, Certainly, but on the other hand...
This is 24-hour searching.
Do you dispute this?
Of GPS location.
Do you dispute this is invasive?
I don't dispute that it's invasive, but for somebody who is subject to parole supervision for life, it's not the same invasive. It's not more of an incremental increase in the invasion that's already happening under PSL. It is invasive. PSL is invasive. PSL, as Justice Altman was describing, parole officers get to ask where you've been and what you're doing. They do get to find out who you're associating with.
That's different from having something attached to your leg that has to be charged. If you're going to play, you have to... You take off,
every second of the day,
right,
as compared to an officer asking you in a back and forth interview.
And
there is a significant difference. Would you agree?
It's not that it's not significant, but PSL is significant. So as compared to someone who's already on PSL, I'm not talking that it's... Look, GPS location, this court has said, and Earl said again in Manning, like, GPS location is a very real search, and you can learn a lot about a person.
Why shouldn't we've been talking about the balancing. Why shouldn't that be dynamic? And when I say dynamic, the balance changes over time. So when the person is first put on PSL, the balance may be, at one point, a year, 2 years, 3 years, the balance may be at a different place. The government interest may recede, whereas the privacy intrusion remains just the same, burdensome, invasive. So why shouldn't there be a dynamic balancing over time?
Well, by SOMA connecting it to Tier 3, it allows for a dynamic balancing. To the extent that someone would like to seek review and to get off of electronic monitoring, they have an opportunity to go to court and ask and to make the point that things have changed.
That's different. This is under the Fourth, because special needs is under the Fourth Amendment. So we're not in statutory country now. We're balancing, when the Constitution allows it and when the Constitution no longer allows it in terms of the balance, right?
Yes, I mean, in this case, the legislature has found that, has made a number of findings about public safety and about what the need is. I hesitate, I understand that there is some more recent literature that has been cited to this court and to other courts about things that have changed. And I just want to push back on this notion, though, that this court has to come in that with the amount of time that's passed or just with time that's passed. I mean, the facts of this case alone demonstrate that 35 years later, not much has changed with this particular individual. And again, to the extent that HR wants to go in front of a judge and wants to argue that there's research that shows when time has passed and because of all the good behavior that he has demonstrated he chose to lure a child 35 years later. And so I understand the court's concern about time, but the legislature has also very concerned about the fact that in many, many cases, the amount of time that has passed doesn't necessarily change someone's dangerousness.
This is you yourself were concentrating on individualized assessment. No one's saying that there shouldn't be individualized assessment for HR or for anyone else. You said that's precisely what should be occurring, correct?
Yes, and I think that's already what is occurring. And to the extent that someone doesn't go to court and ask to have their tier challenged and challenges the constitutionality of the statute, they haven't asked for an individualized assessment. They're asking for a blanket statement that Tier 3 offenders are no longer dangerous and therefore or shouldn't be considered so dangerous, that this is all so overblown.
And your point is, while invasive, nonetheless in the balancing and for other factors, this is an appropriate special needs search.
Yes, and I think that's borne out by the legislative findings and I think that the court below, the appellate division, did a very nice job in analyzing that balance under the circumstances.
Other questions, anyone?
One, two. I'm sorry.
I just want to take you on a curveball for a minute. IR, that's before us today?
It is not.
Okay. No curveball.
No curveball.
The data that's being cited, I don't want to get into the details at this late hour, but the data that's being cited does not deal with Tier 3. It's more general data. Is that your contention?
It is, and it doesn't speak to, there's a lot of problems with that data, which is also the problem with relying on it in a situation like this in front of the Supreme Court for the first time. They're not facts that have been found in this case. It hasn't been able to be vetted. It doesn't speak to the underreporting there continues to be a lot of research about how there's just underreporting of sex offenses. And it doesn't also really deal with the fact that to the extent that there is maybe some more recent data that is showing that maybe recidivism rates are less, it doesn't speak to the fact that over the past, I don't know how many years since Megan's Law, that there has been more intense monitoring of sex offenders. So to the extent that it's demonstrating that the rates are coming down, it's just as likely that to the extent the rates are coming down, it's because there is increased monitoring. And our society, our public, our children is more safe. And so I think it's difficult to stand here and say, because there's a handful of articles, that all of a sudden the legislative findings after doing a 2-year pilot program and the report that was done after the legislature acted, that they were told that it showed that nationwide data, that our statistics are better in New Jersey with electronic monitoring, that it's not just incremental, that every child that doesn't get assaulted or every person that doesn't get assaulted by a recidivist sex offender, that's a big deal, that matters. And I think the electronic monitoring, the report that was done, that was borne out. So,
anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Duddy, brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'll start with your question, Justice Patterson, which is, does the data cited by the petitioner and co-counsel here, does it speak to high-risk offenders, Tier 3 offenders? And the answer to that is it does, most unequivocally. One of the studies we cited, too, is why high-risk offenders will not be high-risk forever. It was a 2014 study based on a 20-year follow-up period of 8,000 sexual offenders, and it found that those who were deemed high-risk, tantamount to Tier 3 in New Jersey, actually presented a much less risk to recidivate in the future than even moderate or low-risk offenders.
And just following up on Ms. Schuster's comment, does that include the fact that they may be monitored?
No.
These are all unmonitored?
No, it doesn't, because that study written by Carl Hansen, which this Supreme Court has cited a number of times in Megan's Law cases, was conducted with a sampling from Canada, and they don't even have Megan's Law there, let alone GPS.
How can we rely on this study?
This court has cited the Carl Hansen 3 or 4 times.
Fine. And this study or Carl Hansen?
Carl Hansen, and there's no difference in the methodology between the study that's in my brief that I'm talking about now and the studies on which this court had already relied.
All I can say is, for a study that has not been tested in the crucible of the trial court, for this court to be accepting it for the first time on so momentous a case, yes, would really be unusual.
So no more unusual than what this court did in Doe versus Poritz, when it predicated its entire legal analysis on 3 studies, one of which from 1973, one from 1985, and one from 1991. We're only here today based on 3 studies or 4 studies that the AG submitted in 1994. And so I'm asking no more of the court than what the AG did 25 years ago.
For the last number of years, when we have been concerned about an issue, we have remanded it to make certain that those studies are tested in the place where they should be tested. Trial court, where everyone gets a say, where the expert is cross-examined, and where other studies can be introduced.
That's an understandable point. I point to these studies not to suggest that there can't be a sex offender registry or anything like that, just to make the point that if the state wants to turn the ratchet down tighter through something like GPS surveillance, it ought to have a justification to do that. And so far as I can tell, there is no evidence to support that. There's only the contrary evidence, the Hansen study, something like that. And so my last couple points are that the state said that the scale is a useful tool. That's not what our courts have said. They say it's presumptively accurate, and only in the quote-unquote rarest of cases, a case in which a fact for which the scale does not account, Can you depart from that scale? And why I kind of point that out is that I understand the point you're making, Justice Alvin, about maybe invoking some form of judicial review as time goes by. And that certainly relates to the balancing test, the government's interest as more time goes by. I would definitely agree with that, as Mr. Shalom said. But I kind of caution the court about really tethering your decision to the risk scale or Megan's Law. And this harkens back, and this is my final point, Chief Justice Ravner, to what I was talking about in my closing with respect to your dissent, Justice LaVecchia, which is that, you know, when I look at this case, I say, well, we already have a framework in place for the search of parolees, and we already have an existing framework in place for special needs searches. It's already been in place, must be minimal, can't result in penal consequences. And so if you were to agree with the state's position here, or even take, I say this not as a pejorative term, a half measure, because it would still be preferable, as you're suggesting, Justice Alvin, you're really eroding the criteria that's been in place for a long time now. We're coming up with something completely new out of whole cloth. And so that's my final comment, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you to counsel for the very fine advocacy all around. Take the matter under advisement. Courts in recess.